Good evening. This is Truth Quest with Melody. And, of course, that was John Lennon, Give Me Some Truth. And tonight I've got a special guest who is returning, and this is Colonel Dan Marvin. And while I'm at it, I'll go ahead and read the disclaimer, but every time I try to find it, it's hidden here, so... Anyways, this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida, and it's buried again, so I'll just have to find the disclaimer again to read it. So anyways, Colonel Dan, are you there?
I am here, and I'm happy to be here.
Okay, and while we're at it, I'll go ahead and... Colonel Dan was born in Detroit on the 10th of October 1933, and he joined the U.S. Army in June of 52. Marvin was commissioned as second lieutenant in 63, volunteered for the counterinsurgency and guerrilla warfare training. The following year, he became a student at the Special Warfare Center in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and as a member of the Special Operations Forces, he claims he was involved in assassinating enemies of the United States. In 1964, he was part of the contingency mission to blow the hydroelectric plant at the Aswan Dam in Egypt, under construction at the time by the Soviet Union. Marvin commanded a Green Beret Team A-424 in South Vietnam, December 65 through August 66, and he was head of a 12-man Special Forces team that was ordered to attack the Viet Cong sanctuaries in Cambodia. In June of 1966, the CIA asked Marvin to assassinate Cambodian Crown Prince Norodom Sihanouk using his Waho. Is that how I pronounce it?
Waho.
Right. Waho. Irregular fighters in an operation designed to make it appear to have been carried out by the National Liberation Front. This mission was accepted but later aborted when President Lyndon B. Johnson failed to honor the quid pro quo, wherein Marvin demanded that Johnson deny the enemy their safe havens inside Cambodia and announce the fact that publicly to the United States. Marvin's next foreign tour was the 46th Special Forces in Lopburi, Thailand, where he commanded the Special Forces Logistical Operations Center, which provided unconventional logistical support to all covert operations in that area of the world. He retired as Lieutenant Colonel in May of 73 and started a furniture refurbishing shop in Trumansburg, and in 1995, Marvin claimed to have been solicited by an agent of the Central Intelligence Agency to terminate William Pitzer. An interview with Marvin later appeared in the sixth episode of the television series The Men Who Killed Kennedy in November of 1995. And he's author of the book Expendable Elite 2003, and he's currently working on the smoking gun conspiracy to kill LCDR William Bruce Pitzer. Now, this is a little bit later than, well, it was printed.
That book was actually written by Kent Heiner.
Okay, all right. Well, this is, I wonder where I pulled this off of some site that had your biography anyway.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of them on there.
Well, where would you like to start tonight?
Well, that would be up to you because you're the hostess.
Well,
I'm just the man that's answering questions and bringing out anything you'd like me to bring out. I've had a very interesting life. I'm 74 years old. I'm still fighting evil in government, and that's been my main goal, really, is to fight the evil in the military hierarchy and in our government.
Well, I guess there's
the book. You've read the book, right?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I did get through it.
General Quang Van Dang, the general who actually saved our lives when the CIA had sent a regiment to kill me and my men, General Quang Van Dang, at the urging of the Buddhist Waho Central Committee chief, flew in over that regiment in a helicopter of Colonel William Desabree, his senior advisor, and radioed down to the regiment and asked them why they were on their way to attack my camp. And they told General Dang that they were going after an American captain, a renegade captain named Marvin, who was leading the Wahaos against the central government, which was a big lie. But what it was is that I had canceled, unilaterally aborted, a mission to assassinate Sihanouk, as you had explained, because President Johnson refused to go along with a quid pro quo. He insisted on always giving the enemy sanctuaries all along that border, which General William Westmoreland admitted in his book, A Soldier Reports. And in fact, in my book, Expendable Elite, I quote General Westmoreland, as I did in court down in Charleston, South Carolina, when they tried to destroy my publisher and myself and get the book off the market. General Westmoreland himself told how he was ordered not to tell the Congress or tell the press that our country, was actually giving sanctuary to the enemy all along the border of Cambodia with Vietnam. Now, there's no other person that could give the commanding general of all military operations an order not to tell Congress unless it was a man above Congress, which would have to be the President of the United States.
Colonel Dan, I wanted to give the views expressed on this program are those of myself and my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHAN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And, you know, when you mentioned with, them going, the United States forces going after your group, it reminds me a little bit of the storyline in Apocalypse Now. Does
That's very interesting. Actually, you said United States troop. It was the CIA sent an Arvin regiment.
Right. You're right.
I knew one of the sergeants that was on that team that movie was based on, and I doubt that anybody will ever in writing state that movie was based on the truth, but it's a fact that the team of special forces, just like mine, an independent operation, was sent to the Cao Mau Peninsula, which is the southernmost portion of South Vietnam, to work with a Catholic priest named Father Hoa, H-O-A, actually spelled the same as the first part of Hoa Hao. And he developed an organization of Catholic irregulars or mercenaries, whatever you want to call them. We call them both. The same as I did Buddhist Hoa Haos. And he cleared the entire Kamau Peninsula of the enemy. There are no more Viet Cong in that area. And for some reason, the CIA may be thinking they were getting too strong, the same as in my area where they ordered my team out. They ordered his team out. And every man on his team left except the colonel who was in command. And they sent two Green Berets back into there and killed them. And that's what actually happened in the apocalypse at An Phu, the real thing, the real apocalypse. Apocalypse Now, I mean.
Uh-huh.
And the apocalypse at An Phu was very similar, only all of my men stayed with me when we were ordered out of there. And we beat off all the enemies, both friendly and otherwise.
Well, it definitely reads like a book that should definitely be made into a movie.
Yes, I hope so. I hope and pray it does.
Uh-huh.
I'd like to pay off the attorney's fees.
Yeah, that would be. So why don't you get into your book a little bit and explain the story behind that for those who hadn't.
Well, I volunteered, as all of us did, to go to Vietnam. And when I reported in to Colonel William Tuttle in Can Tho, South Vietnam, now Colonel Tuttle was a Special Forces, a Green Beret colonel, full colonel, who was in charge of all operations in the 4th Tactical Zone of Vietnam. And he called me into his office and asked me if I would volunteer to take An Phu, which was to be an independent operation. That means that once you go in there, you have no boss. It's up to you completely. You also have no protection. Like he explained to me, I would be volunteering, and all covert operations, all top secret operations are always volunteer, because they can't order you to do something illegal, and basically that's what you're doing in most cases. He asked me if I would volunteer to take the command in An Phu and be the first to take the war into Cambodia, into those sanctuaries that our president, President Lyndon Baines Johnson, had given the enemy. I accepted the mission, but it was with the understanding that if we got caught inside Cambodia, there would be no artillery support, there would be no Air Force support, and there would be no medical evacuation support. And if we were caught inside of Cambodia or killed inside of Cambodia, we would be dropped from the rolls as a deserter of the United States Army. That's one of the kinds of situation that goes on. I'm sure it was the same kind of situation in Apocalypse Now down the Cao Mau Peninsula. I just assume it's that because it's never in writing. Nothing mm-hmm. is in writing. That protects our government, and it also protected my next commander, who never really knew that I had those special orders. He assumed I was under his command, and when I didn't do what he told me to do, he threatened to court-martial me. But I ran my district the way that I wanted to do it, and I had the best fighting men in the world, those Vietnamese Hoa Hao irregulars. They were absolutely outstanding. The people were the finest people in the world. Well, we were in there. We cleared the area of Viet Cong, just like they did down in the Cao Mau Peninsula, so that we had no more Viet Cong within the district of Anfu, which is a geographical district. About that time, the CIA sent a man named Walter McKim into my camp to meet with myself and Major Foy Van Lee, who was my counterpart. He actually commanded the Buddhist Wahao Irregulars. Sent him in, he came into my camp and asked me if I would volunteer. Like I say, it's all volunteer, to set up an assassination operation to kill Cambodian Crown Prince Norodom Sihanouk. And he said, I told him, yes, I would accept that, but I gave him a quid pro quo, that President Johnson would have to tell the American people that there would be no more safe havens for the enemy, there would be no more use of the Mekong River under our protection to carry weapons and ammunition to the enemy inside of Cambodia, who could then shoot those weapons with that ammunition against our forces on this side of the border, and they couldn't fire back. In the very start of the book, I tell about flying over a camp called Vinh Gia. Vinh Gia was right on a border canal between Vietnam and Cambodia. Well, he was under orders, as was every other operation in Vietnam, Special Forces, except mine, which was independent. He was on orders not to fire into Cambodia. Well, one night, he got a lot of recoilless rifle and mortar rounds into his camp, an American Special Forces camp, that had killed five of his men and wounded some others. So he decided, the heck with that, he was going to fire back at the enemy because they were the enemy. And he did. And the next day, he was already on the way to the United States and ended up in Leavenworth Prison for disobeying the order of the President of the United States, which gave those enemy, our enemy, the sanctuaries. Well, from then on until June of 1966, we were cleaning up the area and taking care of the people there in Anfu, wonderful people. And Walter McKim brought that request. Like I said, I accepted it 2 days before we were, by the way, we got 100 and some volunteers, which we selected 42 out of that. And then my men trained them and equipped them so that they would look like a Viet Cong unit in all black pajamas, which is what we normally wore at night anyway. And with the captured weapons, no man would have any personal identification on them whatsoever, so that if they were caught or killed, they could not tie them in with our area in Anfu, my particular district people. And within 2 days of those men being prepared, being trained by my men, and we actually obtained a watercraft that would carry this group up into Cambodia from a native, we actually stole it from somebody to use it for that operation, so the VC would, people in Cambodia would think it was a Viet Cong boat that was going up the river, and they would let it go up the river because they were used to that. And Walter McKim came back to our camp, and he asked if we were ready to go, and I said, well, I don't have the answer yet from President Johnson. And I had a man standing by all this time in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, waiting to get a copy of the New York Times, because it had to be in that New York Times, too, that he was on the radio and told the American people that he was ceasing the enemy sanctuaries, that I hadn't got any word from him at all. And we were on direct communications through what we call bouncing on a satellite with our single sideband radio. We could reach Fort Bragg just at certain times of the day. We didn't have there were no satellites up there in those days. We were bouncing off
the ionosphere?
Excuse me?
Is it the ionosphere?
The ionosphere. Okay. Thank you very much. Yeah, she did read my book. And He didn't even want to talk about that, so I kicked him out of my camp, and I unilaterally aborted the mission to assassinate Prince Sihanouk. And as he was leaving the camp, he told me, "You can't fight the company, Captain, because you can't win." Well, in about 6 or 7 days, we got word from our agents, which were all female, all of my agents were female, that there was an Arvin regiment on the road coming up the, on the Baysack River in Navy boats coming up to attack An Fu and to kill us all. And that's when we had the Major Foy Van Lee sent an emissary down to meet with the chairman of the Wahao Central Committee. And he went and met from Wahao Village on the Mekong River and went over to Kanto and met with General Quang Van Dang. And General Quang Van Dang then went with Colonel Desabree over that regiment and ordered it back, and he saved our lives that day.
How did he have the clout to be able to do that? If these...
Well, he was the commanding general of all armed forces. The CIA had actually drawn one of his regiments calling Premier Key, who was not our friend. And the CIA worked directly with Premier Key. Well, as soon as General Quang Van Dang got the word from the emissary, the chairman of the Wahao Central Committee, he picked up his phone, and I think it's in the book, and he called Premier Key and said he was taking over the situation. So what he was taking back his unit under his charge.
Okay.
And he was a powerful man. He had charge of all the Vietnamese units in the 4th Corps, which upset General Westmoreland something fierce. And he tried his darndest to get an American unit down in the 4th Corps. We were not considered American units, the Green Berets. We were very special units of working solely with the indigenous personnel and trying to help them to help themselves, to protect themselves, to fight the enemy and win victory. It wasn't American, it was Vietnamese, and we were working with them. General Westmoreland didn't like that, and he tried to intercede and get Americans into the 4th Corps, but General Quang Van Dang refused that the entire time that I was there, anyway.
And what would what was his reasons behind that?
Because, well, the 4th Tactical Zone was his zone to control. It was the most secure zone in all of Vietnam. All of the other areas, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd Corps, where there are American regiments and divisions and everything else, that it was not secure.
Okay.
So why would he want the 4th Corps all of a sudden to be taken over and under American control when they couldn't do anything in the other three corps to control the enemy, and where his people did control the enemy?
Well, you know, you, when you get finished with the book, then you get into the section of dealing with the court system, and you might want to get into that a little bit, too.
That was real interesting, because all of a sudden, I mean, we knew in our hearts, we being my publisher, myself, that we may get sued, because the book brings out some things the CIA just didn't want the American people to know about. So they intimidated, they being the CIA, through the Special Forces Association at Fort Bragg, intimidated 6 of my men to actually draw up a lawsuit against me for $700,000 plus court costs, and then tried to negotiate with me over the phone. This was a Special Forces Association, that they would drop the lawsuit if I just wrote them a letter and allowed them to publish it throughout the world that my book was actually fiction and it wasn't fact. Well, the day that I received, the deputy sheriff brought the suit into my office, I called up Ray Johnson, who was one of the men that was one of the plaintiffs, and he was a personal friend of mine after retirement. And I asked him, I said, "Ray, I can't believe it. I got this lawsuit, and here your name is on it, suing me for $700,000 plus court costs. And he said something more or less like, well, Dai Wee, they call me Dai Wee, which was Vietnamese for captain. All I can say is that they told me to come down there and sign those papers, and I did. And you know that I can't tell you any more about it, more or less. And he couldn't. He'd been intimidated. Like when I tried to reach Lieutenant Strait, who was my exo, he's a retired major. He passed away about a month after the trial ended. When I called and tried to reach him, his wife would not even let me talk to him. She said that they were told that if he talked to me, they would lose their retirement pay. Well, you can't lose your retirement pay, but you convince a wife of that, or somebody that's drawing the retirement pay and thinks that our government has a little bit more power than it really does. So they intimidated my men and took us to court. Chris Milligan decided to go to court with me. He didn't have to because I'd protected him by maintaining 100% copyright. But he and I went to court down in Charleston, South Carolina, which they had picked specifically because it was a town that dearly adored General William Westmoreland. And, of course, the Citadel is there. It's a very pro-military town. And they thought that nobody in that town would possibly vote in a jury to acquit us of any harm or anything, because we were going against the military is the way they tried to pose this. Well, when I was up on the stand during the court action, the senior attorney for the plaintiffs asked me, and by the way, he had been associated with the Green Berets for over 20-some years. He had actually been their attorney when they organized the Special Forces Association. And he asked me, he says, he called me Mr., which bothered me because I always like to be called by my military rank. He said, Mr. Marvin, do I understand it correctly, or words to that effect? I've got the whole transcript. And actually, anybody can go to my website, Expendable Elite, and the entire transcript from the trial is on there. But he asked me more or less, he says, you mean to tell me that you wrote that book hoping the CIA would sue you? And I said, that is correct, sir. And he said, why? And I looked at the jury, and I told him, well, basically the CIA could only sue me for two things. One would be all the top secret information that I have in my book. And it's all clearly marked in all caps, top secret, wherever there's top secret information. And they could have come after me for revealing the name of Walter McKim as a CIA operative, especially one who would actually bring a request for me to kill the leader of another nation. Now, you know all the fuss they've had here recently, in the last couple of years, about releasing the name of a CIA operative who wasn't really even out in the field at the time. And I looked at the jury again, and I told them that I was willing to go to prison for a few years if necessary, if they were to take me to court, because in order to accuse me of that, of publishing that information, writing that information, they'd have to admit that it was a fact. They'd have to admit that all this top secret information in here really happened. They'd have to admit that CIA operative came to my camp and asked me to kill Prince Sihanouk. I said, to me, it would have been worth a few years in prison to have the American public know that we go about killing the leaders of other nations and we do the other things that are mentioned in my book.
Like going over to the other side and...
into Cambodia.
Yeah.
But you know the way I feel. I mean, I'm an old military man. I retired from the military. And any time an enemy shoots at you, you should be able to shoot back at him. Right now in Iraq, and I met with a Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel named Kurt Wheeler, who comes from Casanova, New York here, and a friend of mine, Donald Kruger, and I sat down with him at a table in a local restaurant, and I asked Colonel Wheeler, I said, "You just came back from Iraq." Now, this is a few months back. When the Marines went on a patrol and they ran into the enemy, and the enemy fired at them and then ran into a mosque and fired at them from the mosque, could those Marines fire back at the enemy in the mosque? And he said no. Only the foreign troop, only the local troops, the Iraqis themselves, could fire at the enemy in the mosque. Americans were not allowed to fire at their own enemy in Iraq.
Those situations. I don't know if this sounds dumb or not, but then who would you suspect was the ones that would be blowing up any mosques?
Excuse me?
Who would be the one? Who would you suspect would be anyone that would blow up the mosques? Didn't they have some that?
I would blow up the mosque right away. I'd drop a bomb on the cotton picking thing if they're shooting at my men from it.
Okay, well that's.
That's the enemy.
Okay, well right, but you were saying that they, you know, legally, our troops weren't allowed to do something like that.
No,
so.
I didn't say legally. Oh. You know, during the court trial, they asked me a few questions like. Why didn't you pull your troops out when you were ordered to come out of the Camp Anfu? And I told them because it was an illegal order. You don't have to follow illegal orders. If they asked me to assassinate somebody and I didn't want to do it, they can't take you to trial for not doing an illegal operation or an illegal order. And if they tell you that you can't fire at the enemy in a mosque, that's an illegal order. You should be able to fire at the enemy no matter where he's firing at you from, whether it was a mosque or a Catholic church or a Baptist church, it wouldn't matter. He's using it as a place of operations, of tactical operations, and to kill you from.
But in your book, you know, when those... the CIA wanted to come and assassinate your men.
Oh, okay, now the CIA, Walter McKim had come in early in the game when I was his first over there in my area, and he was with the forerunner of the Phoenix program. And they would come into an area, supposedly knowing the people in that area, and go around and question people. And if they decided on their own, just that team, on their own that this man was pro-communist, they would kill him. Well, I wouldn't allow that. My area, I had 64,000 Buddhist Wahaos and 200 Malaysian Polynesian Choms, and I trusted every one of them. And I made sure that they knew I trusted them because I would not allow Walter McKim into my area to do what he wanted to do to question those people, and I never had any of them turn against us, not a one out of 64,000. But they made their living, more or less, going around and killing people that they thought were enemy sympathizers. Well, I didn't go along with that. And in that particular case, I was right. And we had the most secure area in all of Vietnam, the most secure area in all of Vietnam, in An Phu, because we ran the war the way that a war should be run. We didn't allow, for example, we had to call in what we call the Mike Force, which is a force that sets someplace in Vietnam all ready to be sent to another place in Vietnam to help when they've got too many enemy that are coming against them. And I had a Mike Force team come to my area that came, they weren't fully equipped, and they wanted to, if they attacked, they wanted to be able to destroy my people's villages just to clear them out of the way because they didn't want to worry about the enemy being within any of my people's houses. And Major Foy and my Van Lee, my counterpart, and I met with those officers who came with those Mike Force units, and we told them very simply, you don't destroy any house. We know who the enemy are. They're the people that are shooting at you, and they're not shooting at you from our people's houses. So I just relieved the captain, or lieutenant, I guess it was, and sent him packing, and we just took over command of his unit. And we won the battle. And we didn't destroy any of our people's houses.
Why don't you give a little bit of history of, you know, your life and how you got, before you got into the armed forces.
And, well, my dad left the day I was born. He was no good. He ended up in prison, actually, for raping a 16-year-old girl. I met him once when I was 21 years old, which is I was in the Army then, but I'll finish this part of this. My mother asked me to grow a mustache, which was unusual in those days for a person in the 82nd Airborne Division, and go down and meet my father in Spartanburg, South Carolina. And so I grew a mustache, and I went down there, and I met my dad in a bar, and he didn't like me any more than I liked him, and that's the last time I saw him. But anyway, he left my mother, and we were poor. It was a welfare situation. And it was a good thing it was, really, because my mother wanted to name me Bonnie, because her, the only uncle that she had that was not a drunkard was a man named Bonislaus, but she wanted to shorten it to Bonnie. But the nurse, a welfare nurse, would not allow her to call me Bonnie, and she had a little radio there. And if you're as old as I am, you remember the Amos and Andy show, and they'd play a record on there every once in a while, and they played Danny Boy. That's how I got my name. Daniel was from the song Danny Boy. We moved from Detroit, where I was born, to Chicago when I was about 7 years old, between 5 and 7. And, and by the time I was 9 years old, my mother was working whenever she could, and we'd go around. We'd have to eat at the soup kitchens and go around and begging from rich people in the area to get some potatoes and things like that, and they were good to us. And when I was 9 years old is when I saw the very first man I ever saw hanging and dead. It was in a place called Snake Alley in Chicago, which ran between 43rd and 47th Street in Southside Chicago. And he was a man that had been going around killing and hanging dogs in the area. Well, the dog owners went after him and hung him in a garage. And my friend Johnny Thompson and I saw him there, and he was still warm when we found him. And we went right to the police to report him hanging there. And by the time we got back with the police, he was gone. But it was just a thing that we remembered. When I was 11 years old, I noticed that the high school gangs were stealing groceries from old ladies coming out of the grocery store in Southside Chicago. So I organized a gang of five other guys and myself, all 11, 12 years old, and we used Indian tactics that we learned from watching through the rooftop ventilating system of the Ken Theater on 47th Street. We watched the Indian tactics, and that's what I employed with my little gang. And we get up on top of buildings and throw rocks or bricks or anything down at this high school gang if they went to attack a woman carrying her groceries out of the store. And we always won. We don't know how bad we ever hurt anybody, because as soon as we had them running away, we left the area. But at least the women were safe. And then they got guns, the high school gang did. So me and my boys, we made homemade crossbows. And we used crossbows to fight them. I still have a dream every once in a while that they're tearing down a building in the South Side of Chicago, and they find a skeleton in there with an arrow through it that came from one of our crossbows. But I don't know that we ever actually killed anybody, but we were protecting those women. And
so you're saying you're a pretty rough gang?
Excuse me?
Were you saying you were kind of a rough gang then?
I would say we were.
Okay.
But you had to be rough.
Uh-huh.
This is during the Depression. The women hardly had any money as it was, and then to have to go buy groceries for your family and have it stolen. I mean, we were ourselves going around begging for food, for heaven's sake. The Catholic soup kitchens were the most wonderful thing in the area. And also the Salvation Army, we got our clothes there. So, in fact, I think the first completely new set of clothes I had when I was working at Cornell University, and I was 17 years old, and I was accepted as a janitor in Willard Strait Hall at Cornell University, and I got all brand new clothes, including shoes, boots, trousers, and shirt, all the way up to even a cap. And I enjoyed the work, I guess, because they were taking care of me at the same time. That pretty much, right from working at Cornell, is when I joined the Army. As soon as I was old enough to join, without my mother's permission, is when I joined. The funny thing is, I went to join the Air Force, but you know, in those days, this was in 52, all recruiting offices, and I mean all, every one of them was in the post office building. And in Ithaca, New York, all four of them were in the second floor of the post office in Ithaca, and my best friend was old enough 2 weeks before I was, and he went up and signed in for the Air Force, and I was going to sign into the Air Force and go on up and meet him where he was taking his training, and the door was closed to the Air Force recruiting station. And as I was walking out of the building, I turned and looked to the left through this open door, and here's this big sergeant with all kinds of stripes and ribbons. I mean, he really looked like a man that you'd be proud to know. And he says, "Come here, boy, I'll talk to you while you wait." That's the day I entered the United States Army.
And so then you went, you went to Korea, is that correct?
Well, first of all, I went to Fort Devens, Massachusetts for processing and hauling ammunition. And then we all got to volunteer to go to whichever base. They had five different bases for basic training. And I just asked them which was the meanest one, because that's the one that I'd want to go to so I could be the best soldier in combat anyway. And they said Indiantown Gap, and that's where I went, Indiantown Gap, Pennsylvania. And within 2 weeks of my graduating from basic training, I was made an acting sergeant. In those days, they didn't have enough money to actually promote you and pay you, so they'd make you an acting sergeant. And so I got to be a big bad old sergeant in the basic training company. From there, I volunteered to go to Korea, and I was with 185th Combat Engineers in Korea. We supported the 1st Marine Division. We built roads for them. We laid minefields. We picked up minefields. We built the, when the war ended, we built the prisoner of war exchange compound. And worked on processing dead bodies coming back into South Korea from where they had been killed farther north of the DM, of what was then the DMZ. And came back from Korea. I got out of the Army for a very short period of time. When I decided that civilian life just wasn't for me, it was just too boring, and I went headed on down to Washington, D.C. to re-enlist at Fort Belvoir, Virginia. I was in D.C., and I just happened to notice two sailors who were fighting outside this bar. And I got in between those sailors to try and stop the fight, and they both hit me right at the same time, knocked me cold. And they attended to me and then took me into the bar room. And I drank with them, and they said, "Look, why don't you come and join the Navy?" And I said, "I don't want to be in the Navy. I don't know anything about it. I'm an Army man." I said, "Well, why don't you come and pretend to be one?" Because one of their buddies was on shore leave, and he was exactly the same size as I was and everything. So I went in. I actually, Anacostia Naval Base in 55, I pretended to be a sailor for 5 days.
Hmm.
And to me, they were too good to them. There wasn't much discipline. when you go into the mess hall, you had your choice of what to eat. In the Army, you didn't have any choice in those days. It was a master menu, and if you were in Fort Lee, Virginia, or Sacramento, California, it didn't matter where you were, you ate exactly the same food for that breakfast of that day, or dinner, or supper, or whatever. And I liked the meaner branch, I guess you might say, because it fit more my personality. And I liked the kind of guys that were in the Army, too, that are willing to go and fight on the battlefield, no problem with that, especially in the airborne. Then I volunteered for the airborne and went to jump school at Fort Bragg, North Carolina in 1955. And or 56, one or the other, I can't remember it right offhand right now, and then was assigned to the 82nd Airborne Division, and from there I went to 18th Airborne Corps, and then down to 3rd Army Headquarters, and from there I was made a first lieutenant on a special program where 19 sergeant first classes in the whole United States Army were tested by going to the different commands, like I was, from the 82nd Airborne Division, 18th Airborne Corps, and then 3rd Army Commanding General's Office. And I was appointed direct commission as a first lieutenant down at Fort McPherson, Georgia. And, that was absolutely outstanding. Of course, my family was very happy about that, too.
So how did you end up in the Green Berets?
And then I volunteered to become a Green Beret, right? And, I'll tell you what happened. I was out at Yuma, Arizona, actually, testing parachutes. And because they were already airborne. And Yuma, Arizona is one of those places where we tested all kinds of parachutes, Polish, Russian, all different kinds of parachutes, jumping everything from 3,000 feet over the Colorado River Basin, so everything we tested for water drop at the same time as we did airdrop. And we lost one man while I was there. He released his parachute too far above the water, and he went down, and his feet got stuck right in the bottom of the water, and we had to go down and pull him out. But on the 22nd day of November of 1963, when President Kennedy was assassinated, is the day that I volunteered for Green Beret training, because he was a hero of all the military paratroopers especially, but even more so the Green Berets. And my best friend was a Green Beret, Master Sergeant Gerard V. Parmentier. I volunteered in November, the same day that Kennedy was assassinated. I went to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, when in 2 months I was going through their school for Special Forces officers, and one of the first things that really hit me hard was in the assassination, terrorism, and industrial sabotage training, which was conducted mostly by CIA instructors in a special building surrounded by barbed wire and with guard dogs running around it, Doberman pincers. They taught us about the assassination of President Kennedy. Excuse me.
And that was within the first couple of months after...
Yep. Well, 1964. And they explained how there was 4 mafia people involved in the killing of President Kennedy. 2 of them were American mafia, one of whom I know personally. His name is Jimmy Files. He's in Joliet Prison. There's been a book written about him being the actual killer of President Kennedy from the grassy knoll. There's been a film about it. It's also that I've seen. And I met him, and we started corresponding. I've been in fact, I just got another letter from him just the other day. But there was 2 American mafia. One was on the grassy knoll. They didn't tell us any names, of course. One was on the grassy knoll, and the other one was on the rooftop of the building that adjoined the Texas Book Depository. Oswald had nothing to do with that assassination. He worked for the CIA, was doing work for them, and they happened to put him there, I think, to use him as a target for the investigation to hold him responsible for it. But anyway, there was...
Was the name of the other...
killed Kennedy from the grassy knoll. Now, the other two mafia people were from the Corsican mafia. And they were on two different routes from the time where Kennedy was hit to the hospital. There's two different routes that the driver could have been ordered to go. And there was a Corsican mafia man with a spotter with high-powered binoculars. Now, this is what the CIA told us. With binoculars, and that man with the binoculars, the spotter, was to determine, as that vehicle went by with Kennedy in it, if he was going to make it to the hospital and live. And if he thought he would, just a person's thought of this spotter, then the shooter would kill him from that point, halfway to the hospital.
Was one of the names of the other guys Frank Sturgis?
Does I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know any of them except just Jimmy Files.
Yeah, I think I've heard, it was a Jim Rothstein that did some investigating on that. And
I don't know.
Okay. So I find it interesting that they, you know, told you about that in such a short period of time.
Well, it was top secret, and I mean, it was kind of like you wouldn't tell that to anybody unless you wanted to lose your life, so to speak.
Okay.
We were training to be assassins for the CIA, and when we were given a mission to assassinate somebody, it was like this. They would ask you if you would, let's say, for example, I was asked, like, say, in Vietnam, I was about to go on R&R to Manila in the Philippines, and an intelligence officer meets me on the boat dock, and he said, we'd like you to take care of this man. Would you do it? And it's always volunteer, and so you accept that mission, and then go to the Philippines, and you take care of that man. You don't even know why they want him dead. Doesn't matter. You're doing what they think should be done. And in your mind, and I'd say there's a lot of his mind control, you don't care who it is or what they've done or what they could do. All you care is that they asked you to take care of him, to make sure that he was silent in the future. And then you go and do it, and then if you make it back, then you're picked right back up in your unit. Well, it was, you know, fifth day of August of 1993, I believe it was, the CIA agent came to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and Colonel C.W. Patton, who was my commanding officer, said he wanted to meet me under the trees for some mission. And he asked me if I would be willing to kill somebody who was about to give secrets to the enemy. And I said, certainly. And I said, who is it? And he said, U.S. Navy Lieutenant Commander William Bruce Pitzer. Well, I assumed that Colonel Pitzer was overseas because I was on orders to go to Vietnam at the time. And we were instructed.
Okay, you said 93. Did you mean 63 then?
60.
Okay.
No. I meant 30 years later.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't. All right.
This William Bruce Pitzer happened to be the man who took the photographs of the JFK assassination, and he was about to retire from the United States Navy.
Okay.
They wanted to get those pictures because those pictures proved beyond a reasonable doubt, beyond any doubt. In fact, Dennis David, who I gave you the name of, he actually stood next to Commander Pitzer and saw all those pictures that were taken of the autopsy, which approved, period, that Kennedy was not killed by a bullet coming from the back of his head. So so I asked him, well, where is he? Because I was on my way to Vietnam, like I say. Said he's at the Bethesda Naval Hospital. And I told him, no, I can't do that. By the way, you were right. It was in 1995 when I found out why he was killed. It was in 65.
Okay.
They asked me to do that, right? But anyway, I refused it because he was in this country. And I said, look, I said, they taught us that we were used overseas in the mafia. Hitmen were used for any hits inside the United States of America. And so I told him, no, I just refused it. Well, he let me go, and there was another Green Beret waiting, and he talked to him. And I don't honestly know who killed William Bruce Pitcher, but he was killed. He was shot to death in his office, and his body was found at the bottom of a ladder. And I assume that whoever had killed him had got there at the time when he finally found out where he had hidden those photos of the assassination, of the autopsy. That was in 1993, I believe it was, that they had a 30-year anniversary TV special on the Kennedy assassination. And at the end of the special, they showed a list of the names of people that were killed as a part of the cover-up of this assassination, and Lieutenant Commander William Bruce Pitcher's name was there. I put aside everything, and I went to find out why he was killed. You know, and because what they had said about him about to give secrets to the enemy didn't make any sense unless we were the enemy, and the secrets were the JFK autopsy photos.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally found, through some help of some friends, the widow of William Bruce Pitcher. And I called her. And I don't know whether I sent you a copy of the conversation that I had with her. In fact, we gave that to the jury down in Charleston, South Carolina. I called Mrs. Pitcher and recorded the conversation. I explained to her that I had been asked by the CIA to kill her husband, and that I wanted to know why, you know, what she knew about it and everything else. And she told me that she, after he was found dead, she had been told by, I think, 3 Navy intelligence officers not to ever discuss his death with anybody, period, as long as she lived. And so she was afraid to talk about it much. But we had quite a conversation. I learned a lot. She knew that he was getting out, and he was going to have a job with a television station. And then I ran into Dennis Davin and talked to him and what he knew about the whole situation. And I finally demanded to get a copy of any investigations that were made in those days, and I got the whole 9 yards from both the state of Maryland, from the FBI, and from the Navy investigators. And without a doubt in my mind, he'd been killed, and he didn't commit suicide, but they still ruled it a suicide.
Well, when they showed that list on TV of names affiliated with JFK's assassination, was it rather lengthy?
42 names at that time. Now it's all the way up to 102.
Wow. And what
people like myself were used to silence those people.
And it's just he keeps growing and growing. To cover the lie. Then apparently.
Well, most of them are dead now.
Uh-huh.
By one reason or another. But, you know, when all of a sudden maybe you got the man who's... when you talk to Dennis David, you'll find out that there was 2 different caskets delivered to the hospital there in Bethesda, Maryland. Dallas, Texas. And the one of the caskets, he was there, and one of the caskets had Kennedy's body and the other one didn't. I don't know who was in the other one, but there's a lot of strange things going on, and the people that actually drove those vehicles were witnesses, of course, to different things. Dennis David was ordered not to say anything about the ammunition that he was given, that was taken from the body.
What was his job there? Why was Dennis there?
Oh, he was a Navy corpsman in the hospital.
Oh, okay. All right.
A lot of strange things happened. And I guess that, let me see. You had to read that book, Without Smoking Gun.
Okay.
That gives all the details. I'm getting too old to remember everything about everything. I'm not there, but the things that I was personally involved in, I've got down pretty pat.
So how did you end up with so much information? I mean, you just must have really done a major investigation to have as much information as you did to help contribute to that book then.
Oh, the book was no problem, because when Colonel William Tuttle, on Christmas Day, I believe it was, of 1965, offered me the independent operation and told me that when I left that door, it would be as if I'd never met him. From that day forward, I sent home information. Well, actually, I sent to a friend of mine at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, using Vietnamese mail channels to start with instead of American. I sent them 3x5 cards with information I'd written on there of what we'd done that day. I sent them copies of secret and top secret messages. Anything that happened in my camp during that 7 months that I was there, I put information on that to include copies of actual monthly operational summaries and things of that nature in envelopes and sent them to this friend of mine in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, who's dead now. And he was told, and he accepted the job because he was concerned about me too, that he kept them sealed and that if something were to happen to me, he would deliver them to an attorney that we trusted in Fayetteville, North Carolina. When I finally decided to write the book in 1984, after I no longer feared what the government would do because I got saved, and I feared only the Lord Jesus Christ, and that's a fact, I sent for all those envelopes, and I got them, and I'm glad I did, because within a couple of years of that, he was dead, and I wouldn't have been able to ever get them. But in those, I mean, there was like a footlocker full of envelopes.
And let me take a break here just a second and say this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida. This is Truth Quest, and my guest this evening is Colonel Dan Marvin. Okay.
Okay, where was I?
Okay, it was the envelopes, and he was...
Right.
Okay.
He had about a footlocker full of sealed envelopes. And I took all that information and some of the actual copies of the top secret and secret reports. Some of them were shown to the jury down there. Those, all the notes from the 3x5 cards, I just wrote it out in a narrative for the book, and I destroyed all the cards. But my whole memory was right there in cards and copies of documents. So, except for things that my own men, in 87, when I finished the first manuscript on this, I sent it out to those men I could find, and they'd send me back, like John Strait, my executive officer. He told me about the time that I'd saved his life, and it completely escaped my memory, but he explained it in detail on the audio tape, and I put that in the book. And anything that he or Sergeant Johnson or Jackson or any of them gave me over the phone or by audio tape, I included that in the book, so I know that the book is a book of truth. because it doesn't contain any speculation or anything of that nature.
Your book, Expendable Elite, you still have legal bills, and that this by the sale of that, that's helping you pay for those, is that?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yes, we need to sell as many as we can because we still owe approximately $70,000 to our attorneys. And God bless them. They were good attorneys, obviously. It was so interesting just seeing the expressions on the faces of the attorneys for the plaintiffs when the jury brought in the verdict for us and against them. They earned their money. It cost us $152,000 in legal fees, and we still, like I say, owe about $70,000. And if anybody wants to order a book, all they got to do is call 800-556-2012. That's 800-556-2012. And if they want a signed copy, they can ask Chris Milligan, who's the publisher, for a signed copy. And then what he'll do is he'll send me a message, an invoice, telling me exactly where to mail it to. And he sends me enough books, so I'll mail them right from here.
And your website is called Expendable Elite?
ExpendableElite.com.
Okay, and so they can get a lot of that information off that website, too.
In fact, they can order right on the website, but they can't order a signed copy on the website. They have to do that by telephone.
Okay. And, you have a whole lot of other experiences. I mean, how much longer were you, when did you get out of the service?
1973.
Then why were they still coming to you to do assignments?
No, like I said, you were right. That was back in 65.
Okay, right. Okay, so
93, 30 years anniversary of the death, that they had that special where I saw William Bruce Pitzer's name, and I'm glad I caught it because his widow was getting quite old by then.
Uh-huh.
And who knows, if I had not noticed that at all, I might never have known why William Bruce Pitzer was murdered. And that's how I found out.
You have an interesting story about, was that the one about, was it meeting Frank Sinatra, or?
Oh, when I commanded the very first Green Beret 8-man team on portable atomic bomb. It's called a SADM, S-A-D-M, Special Atomic Demolition Munition. And I volunteered. We were all volunteers because it was more or less a suicide mission. The scientist that brought the first one down from Seneca Army Depot right here in New York State to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, to brief us on the whole situation was a man who had actually recommended that this portable atomic bomb be developed for special forces use, and it was actually the trigger to the hydrogen bomb. It had the same explosive potential as 10 tons of TNT, and I could carry that right on my back. 95 pounds was what the bomb weighed, and the trigger for it was 35 pounds, and that my executive officer would carry. Well, we had a mission, what they call a contingency mission, to blow the hydroelectric plant at the Aswan High Dam, which was under construction at the time, as you had mentioned earlier in the show, by the Soviet Union, who were our enemies. And I had received plans for that hydroelectric plant, and I wondered how our government got those plans. Well, it turns out Master Sergeant Joe Hill and I were asked by General Yarborough, who was the commanding general of Special Forces, to be the final trainers on, testers on some top secret equipment for Special Forces. And we went to Natick, Massachusetts, and to do the final testing, which included jumping from Otter aircraft. But
with those bombs?
Excuse me?
With those bombs?
No. This is testing some special forces equipment.
Oh, okay.
Right. No. The bombs you actually dropped from 30,000 feet from a C-130 aircraft. Those days, that was about the only one that could really be used for that particular mission.
Uh-huh.
But we got there, and they put us up in a Holiday Inn Hotel, which I believe is still there. This was in 1964. And Frank Sinatra happened to be there. Well, we knew if Frank Sinatra was there, the Mafia would be there. And I always got kind of a kick out of the Mafia, because, you know, when I was in Chicago as a young lad there with my own little gang, my hero, I know this sounds funny, but my hero was, oh my goodness gracious.
Al Capone?
Al Capone, thank you very much. My mother had a high regard for him because he used to go out on the street corner before he was sent to prison, and he'd hand out dollar bills to anybody passing by that was poor. And my mother had gone and got some dollar bills from him one time or another. And he was my hero until years later, when I was working on a farm, and all of a sudden General MacArthur and Patton and all them became my heroes. But anyway, this was in 1964. And so we went and we listened to Frank Sinatra, and Sergeant Joe Hill and I were both in uniform, both had our green berets on the table, and we were drinking. I always drank vodka in those days. I don't drink anything now. And he drank something else. I can't remember what it was. But drinks kept coming to the table free. So I asked the waiter three times who was sending over the drinks, and he wouldn't tell us. So finally I got a hold of his arm, and I told him, I'll break your such and such an arm unless you tell me who's buying these drinks. So he pointed over to a table, and here's this guy sitting with a pinstriped blue suit, just like you'd see a picture of the Mafia in the movies. And so we got up and walked over. Now, Joe Hill, I'm 5'10". I weighed about 175 pounds then. And Joe Hill was 6'4", and weighed 230-some pounds. He was a big sucker, like John Wayne. And we walked over to the table, and we asked this gentleman why he was sending the drinks to our table. And he said, well, it's the first time in my life that I've seen a captain and a sergeant drinking together that looked like they really enjoyed each other's company. And I said, well, we're on the same team. I said, you know, if we had to go out and dig a ditch, we had to go out and dig a latrine, we'd take turns digging, but he'd never have any doubt in his mind that I was the commander. And when we go into an operation, I'm the only one that gives orders. But we have to work together on everything that we do so we can get the job done. So he asked us to join him, and we joined him and listened to Frank Sinatra. And we came back two or three times during our visit down there, and we meet him. And the third time, he took us to meet his father. Well, it turns out on the way, he explains that his father is the Don of the Boston area Mafia. And we passed by police stations, and he introduced us to three different policemen just by seeing them that were on their payroll, on the Mafia payroll. And we got to his dad's house, and we had filet mignon. We had just a wonderful meal and drinks. And then his dad asked us to go into the living room, and he had it all set up there, and Joe and I sat down on the sofa, and in front of us on this coffee table was a beautiful inlaid box. He says, open the box. So we opened the box, and there was two magnificent pistols, silencers and everything, for like a team. And he said, I'm going to offer you a job, because he knew that we'd taken assassination training at Fort Bragg, that we may have been used in that kind of a role. And he offered us a job as a hit team for his company. And he said the salary is $40,000 a year for the two of us. Now, in 1964, $40,000 was a lot of money. And $10,000 for every time that you do me a favor. And he says, I guarantee you, you will never have to kill a policeman or a military man. And you know, I told him, look, I said, you know, I'm happy that you offered us a job and everything else, but I said, I'm not a bachelor like Joe is. I've got a wife and three children, and if all of a sudden I leave the Army and come to work from you, it's not going to be good for the family. And he understood, and he pulled a dagger out of his desk, and he stuck each one of us in our hand. I was showing somebody the scar just last night when I was talking to VFW Club. And we all shook hands and agreed that we would not give our names until they were dead. He's dead now, and his name was Perini, and he had Perini Construction Company. One of the things he told me is that he had been asked by the CIA to send a group of people to go over and work with the Russians to build the Aswan High Dam, and his job was to get the
plans,
specifications, the blueprints on the Aswan High Dam, a place that we were going to put the explosive, the atomic bomb, if the contingency mission was ever called. So we had the complete plans for the power generation part of the dam right at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And they were in my custody, actually, because that was my job as the commander of that team. And I asked him, I said, were you involved at all in the hit on Kennedy? And he said, I was asked to kill Kennedy right here in the Boston area. But he says, I told the man at the company, he says, I got no problems. We got no problems with the Kennedys here in Massachusetts. Well, they didn't. Edward is there, and he's kind of a cowardly character, and probably lets him get away with just about everything, at least until that day anyway. So that was my experience with the Boston area mafia. You can go on your computer right now and pull up Perini Construction Company, P-E-R-I-N-I, and they've got a voluminous net system. But you go and just plug in their Aswan High Dam, and they're still, to this day, to the best of my knowledge, still bragging about the work that they did in 1964 on the Aswan High Dam, even though the Russians were building it and they were our enemy. But you can do that. You can go right to that website right now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't tell any fables at all. And everything, you know, one of the reasons I had no worry going to that trial, although I'm telling you, my family worried and friends worried. They thought for sure that I'd end up having to get all that money together and go bankrupt.
Well, you know,
we were absolutely certain, because of the documentation that I've maintained, that we would win that court battle.
So did you plan on writing the book when you were over there in Vietnam?
Let me tell you, until I retired from the Army, practically, I felt like anything that they would ask me to do is okay.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are certain things now they ask me to do, like I refused on CNUC, but I refused only because the president refused to quid pro quo. We would have gone ahead with CNUC. I mean, I can't tell you how many I've gone ahead with, because, you know, one of the reasons it's all done in a compartmentalized fashion, any assassination or terrorism or industrial sabotage, it's all done in a compartmentalized situation, so your boss, your real boss, never knows what your mission is.
Do you really agree with people doing that?
No, I don't.
Okay.
The day that I got saved, the day January the 29th of 1984, is the day that I wanted to go out to the world and tell them. That's when I started writing this book. That's when I asked for all those envelopes, and I got all the information. Before that, I'd thought about writing it as a fiction based on fact, and then I thought to myself, well, nobody will know what's fiction and what's fact. So I didn't do that. But once I got saved and I no longer feared the army sending somebody like me to kill me, I worried only about the Lord Jesus Christ. That's when I started in earnest on the book. Got all the information. And it's hard for anybody to read that book and understand completely how I could have all that detail. But if you'd been at that trial, because I had all that detail with me at the trial, and the jury got to see anything they wanted of that detail, and so did the judge, and they looked, and they knew. We spent the 5 days in front of the jury, and then 2 days prior to that, so they knew without a doubt that everything in that book is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
And you might explain to your listeners, or our listeners, that what's unique about that book and why winning this trial or court case was so significant for you.
Well, if you mean that my publisher and I were the very first ones ever, that to the best of my knowledge now, we're the very first ones ever to show up in court against the special operations people. Everybody else had been talked out of it or intimidated one way or another. We had our threats and everything else, too. The Special Forces Association wrote threatening letters to Chris Milligan for publishing the book. They never wrote a threatening letter to me. They tried to get me to come to a kind of a military tribunal set up by the Special Forces, and I refused to go. Instead, I sent them evidence to show that the book was right, the book was the truth. But they were forced, and I believe by the CIA or by President George Herbert Walker Bush, to take us to court to try and destroy us financially so that other books would not come out. For example, The Devious Elite, which I hope will be out in a couple of years, and it will include information, details on every covert operation that I've ever been personally involved in or I'm intimately familiar with in 50 years, beginning with 1962, I believe it was, in France.
I hope you have multiple copies spread out at different places.
Oh, do I ever. In fact, copies of the audio tapes from my men or from anybody else who I've talked to, like the widow of William Bruce Pitzer, copies of all the top secret and secret documents and everything else were sent to at least two other people, none of whom anybody else, none of them know who each other is, you know. It's all very tightly controlled by Old Dangerous Dan to protect me and my family, too. And that's so important, because if you just have one copy of something and then you even give it to your attorney, how do you know you can trust your attorney?
Well, it's kind of significant after the events of last week with that D.C. madam.
Yes. Amen. Good example. Glad I had nothing to do with them.
There's something kind of interesting. I find a little interesting just in the name, the acronym for the name of that SADM, for that portable bomb. I mean, is that what they refer to? Is they talking about mini nukes? That
yeah, when they talk about suitcase nukes and all that by the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically the same thing. Oddly enough, and it's so interesting that for some stupid, and I mean stupid reason, the Army Dictionary of Terms and Abbreviations that was published, in the 60s, had SADM in there, SADM, Special Atomic Demolition Munition. And here it was, a top secret item in an unclassified dictionary. I couldn't believe it. In fact, I used part of that to show the court. And I've had a lot of wars about this book, not just with the court, but with the government and everything. But I've got proof on everything.
But it also goes to show that they've had those things quite a while then.
It's interesting because there was a NPR, and I like NPR. They had a program about atomic weapons, and I called in because they were talking about the atomic bombs and where they were storing them. After they were no longer in use, they didn't destroy. There were no atomic bombs that had ever been destroyed. The two had been dropped over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, of course, and some test bombs. But all the rest of the bombs that were ever made were stored in these mountains. So I called up, and I said, you know, I've written to warn the people in the government on this new command they got going to protect us here in the United States about the SADMs, the portable atomic bombs. It's something that should be guarded special. I said they used to be up at Seneca Army Depot, but that's closed now. So they should make certain that wherever they're at, that they should be safeguarded, doubly safeguarded, because a group of men can just go in and grab these and then use them without hardly any special training or anything. And the guest who had just told 5 minutes before that no bomb had ever been destroyed, he said, we don't worry about them because all of them were destroyed. And then I was cut off. I couldn't ask anymore.
Well, that's kind of interesting, too, is that you're saying that, from what I understand, that chain of command on that plane last year that had the nuclear weapons on it that went from, North Dakota to Louisiana? Are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
I'm not familiar enough to say anything about it.
Okay. Well, it was the only reason I was bringing it up is that, from what I understood, it took, there was 6 or 8 people that had to sign off.
Or the control of atomic weapons.
Right, right.
Yeah, it's a tremendous control. It was an interesting thing, though, the SADM that the scientists brought down from the depot, he brought it in an unmarked vehicle, had no indications in that vehicle at all that there was a bomb on there, especially an atomic bomb. No escorts, no nothing, just the driver and the scientists and the SADM in the back. And it was funny because he almost apologized, because we knew it was a suicide mission. Everybody knew that was had volunteered, because you had to volunteer on that basis. The timer for the first SADM that we used in the Army was a 15-minute timer off a Sears washing machine. Now, 2 years later, Master Sergeant Jerry Wilsey, who lives here in Syracuse, about 20 miles from me, and who's the only other Green Beret of 10,000 active duty and retired Green Berets, he is the only one that's come to me and volunteered to go with me to Congress to talk about this SADM specifically, because he was in the team that I first commanded. And when we first started this program in Special Forces, he was on that same team 2 years later in the same unit, the 6th Special Forces. And he said the only difference was the weapon was the same, but they had a 2-hour delay device on it, timing device. So they had time to get someplace to possibly be safe, from the explosion itself.
Uh-huh.
So I think they're still around someplace.
Well, I find it odd that they haven't. I mean, I just can't imagine them not detonating these things in some event of some sort.
Mm-hmm. You mean the enemy?
Us.
The enemy. It's interesting because when that federal building was hit down there.
Oklahoma City?
Oklahoma City. The two bombs that we and the Green Berets, anyway, felt that were used in that were two that we had very specific training on. One was called the Dust Initiator Charge, and we were taught on this by destroying a railroad boxcar. And what we'd go out in the field, and we'd set up this situation where we had a high explosive D4, plastic explosive, and on top of that was a bag of sawdust permeated with an incendiary. And you'd fire the one off, which would distribute that dust all throughout that whole boxcar, and then the next thing you did was shoot a device that would inflame that, and the whole boxcar would become a bomb. I mean, it just blow to smithereens.
So that would be kind of like lighting a silo of wheat or something?
Yeah, something like that. I've never done that. But that's what we thought. And then the earmuff charges. That's where you take a column and you diametrically oppose charges of C4, plastic explosive, and you ignite them simultaneously. And the explosive charge, it's all mud-packed on the outside, the explosive charge goes into the middle of that column from two sides. And when it hits the middle of that column, the column itself just explodes out in that area. So you have no more column left there. And that's the kind of thing that we felt was used in the destruction of that building. It's kind of interesting, too, that the FBI office on the day that that thing was blown up was completely empty of personnel.
Well, have you ever read...
They knew.
I think it was it Colonel... I think he was a Colonel Craig Roberts. Have you read his Kill Zone, or...
Oh, he's good.
Yeah, he did some investigating on that, and I
Marine
think
Corps Colonel.
He did it on. I don't know if that's a book on that or on the one, because he did one on JFK's assassination too.
Mm-hmm. He's a good man.
I hadn't.
He like a number of us are trying to get the truth out, but you know, like I've sent the information. I think I sent you information on aiding the enemy, which of course starts in my book. And General Westmoreland admitting it in the book that he was ordered not to tell Congress or the press. And I've sent that information to all of the presidential candidates, and not a one of them has even bothered to recognize that they got the information, much less that they do anything about it. And these people are going to be running this nation. And are they just going to continue aiding the enemy? Is that going to be what our presidents do during wartime? We should have only lost about 10,000 men, and the Vietnamese maybe 100,000 in Vietnam. We lost 58,000, lost the war, gave it up, and Vietnam lost, I think, 2 million men in that war.
What do you... When you were done with the Vietnam War and whatever, did you change your opinion of why we were there at all, or did you still feel that you know the reason that you went there and why we were there was the same? Are you following me?
That special forces were there for a very good reason, to work with the local people to defend their own villages and everything, to go against the enemy, and with your just advising them. They're running the show, really, to try and free their own nation of a belligerent enemy. What went bad is when President Johnson took it over and introduced all the American forces in there, and all of a sudden it became an American war. And we weren't allowed to win it because he gave all the sanctuaries along the border to the enemy. And I think it was primarily to support a big drug running operation, but I can't prove that. But I can prove that the enemy had sanctuaries. In fact, I've even got information on that from King Sihanouk's ambassador, who's writing his biography, because I provided him information from our side about those sanctuaries across from my area, and specifically how we attacked them, even though the orders were not to attack them.
Well, you wouldn't be the only one saying that it was had drugs was part of the operation.
I'm not saying that because I don't know it. I think that, but I don't know it. I know that if it was to start all over again, I'd like everything to be run like it was in Anfu District. Throughout the whole nation of Vietnam, there would still be a South Vietnam, and I'm sure of that as I'm sitting here.
And you don't...
We didn't... You know, when you talk to the people in some of those other corps, you know, you even asked me why we didn't want American units in the 4th Corps. Well, when you talk to people who have been displaced from their villages, that have been their villages for hundreds of years, and all of a sudden, it's just leveled by American bulldozers to build an American base in there, and they build a PX in Saigon. Its primary job, I've only been in it once. The one time I went there, and I got so sick just looking at their displays of mostly women's clothing and everything else for the men to buy for what we call musumes, their Vietnamese girlfriends. We should have been there to help them fight a war, period, and not to be doing all the kind of things that we did, air-conditioned quarters and all that kind of stuff in Saigon. I don't care if it's 100 degrees. We don't need to spend money on air conditioning when we could spend it on getting rid of the enemy.
So you don't feel like that the United States kind of accomplished, I mean, what they wanted to by prolonging that war? And
we should have made it a short war. We could have won it very readily. And we betrayed the Vietnamese by doing it the way that we did it.
So that would lead you to start questioning the reasons why we were there then, would it not?
Not the reasons why we were first there, no.
Okay.
But what it evolved to, yes.
Okay.
I'll tell you, I couldn't have been any prouder. I tell people to this day that my best year in my life was my year in Vietnam. Because I felt I was really using all of what I have in me to do good for other people that was in Vietnam. And I don't know of anybody who I would rather be with than the Buddhist Wahaos that I was with in Vietnam. And then for us to betray them and to just let the communists come in. I guess of all the religious orders over there, the ones who were treated the worst after the war was the Buddhist Wahaos.
Now, in the area you were in, was that their normal, where they had lived prior to the war?
Oh, they lived there forever.
Okay,
yep.
All right.
Yep. No, and, you know, 64,000 people, not one automobile, not one truck, not one anything with a motor in it, except they had a few bicycles. The VIS, the Vietnamese Information Service, we did provide them motorbikes. But those people were just living good lives as fishermen and farmers and raising hogs and wouldn't hurt anybody, but they were good at defending themselves, and they're as brave a people as I've ever seen in my life. And how we could just betray them and abandon them to the communists, it's bad, very bad.
Well, definitely.
We should have gone in there, and we should have helped them to the end.
Well, definitely from reading your book, I mean, you definitely sound like you were not the typical run operation. You didn't make a lot of friends with your ranking officers.
No. Nope.
So.
You did it right.
they might have disagreed on that, though, wouldn't they?
I don't think this is in the book, but my B-team commander, Colonel Brewer,
uh-huh.
He threatened to destroy me when I closed my camp. And he told my wife years later at the parking lot in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, by the officers' mess, the officers' club. We just happened to run into him there, and he told my wife how he had threatened to destroy me and that I turned out to be the best officer he ever had under him there in Vietnam in the B team. And, I mean, he was a guy that people were so afraid of that, except for myself, maybe there's somebody else, but I don't know who it was, all the officers assigned to the B team, when they'd walk into the little room they had set up kind of as where they had whiskey and stuff like that, like a little bar, he would set a glass of water out on the table or a glass of beer and make them put their watch inside of that and then put it in the freezer to see if the watch was any good and then get it out the next morning. And they actually did it. I refused to, but they actually did that. And he told my wife that I could believe anything that I'd written about him.
You know, you might get a little bit into I remember his last name, Lee, and
Boy Van Lee.
and General
Quang Van Dang.
Quang, yeah. When they got over here to the United States and how they got here.
Right. Well, I was working through a lady named Alicia Cooper, who was in charge of the Pacific branch of the International Rescue Committee. And I worked through her to get a number of my people that worked with me over there, the Buddhist Wahaos, into this country, most of them into the Wichita, Kansas area. And I couldn't find Major Foy Van Lee. And he was one that, he meant so much to me. We were like brothers over there. So finally, I had the thought, I'll call the former ambassador to the United States, Bui Zim, who I knew and I trusted. And I called Bui Zim. He was down in Virginia at the time. And I asked him how he would help me to get a hold of Major Foy Van Lee, and because I'd heard that he had been released from prison. And so he gave me the telephone number for the United States branch of the Wahao Central Committee. And I called, and this is unbelievable, but it's beautiful, that the time I called, the man who answered the phone, I told him I was trying to find how to reach Major Foy Van Lee, and he said, well, how would you like to talk to his nephew, who was standing right next to him? And so I did, and talked to him, and he told me that he didn't know where I was, and his uncle had asked him to help find me, but because of all the different things I was working on, my name wasn't in the phone book. My wife's name was in the phone book. But he said that his father, Foy Van Lee, had written two letters to me, feeling that I was the only American that he could trust 100%. And he sent one of the letters through the Defense Department and one through the State Department, and I never got on one of them. That had been over a year before that. So I started action through Alicia Cooper to get Foy Van Lee into this country. And she went to a meeting in New York City where they had the International Rescue Committee, the big major meeting. Henry Kissinger happens to be on their board of directors and still is, to the best of my knowledge. And she came back from that meeting and she called me and she says, Dan, I got to tell you that Henry Kissinger has ordered that Lee Van Foy Van Lee, not be allowed into this country. But she said, there's a lady that I think can help you. And she introduced me via phone lines to a Dr. Judith Ledinsky, an exceptionally brave woman as Alicia was. And when I called her, I told her, I says, you realize that Henry Kissinger has ordered that he not be allowed in this country. And she more or less told me, let her worry about that. She happened to be the lead person in a Vietnam American Scientific Cooperation Committee. So the Vietnamese government was depending on her to help them. And she went over there and she met personally with Major Foy Van Lee, and she made sure it took well over a year, all the medical things and everything else. But he and his wife and four children are this day living in Wichita, Kansas, and they're all American citizens, and they're all working hard for our country right now, which is now their country. So, but you can get the job done, but it takes people who are willing to risk their very lives. Not a one of my men would help Foy Van Lee. Not a one of my men. Now, you read in the book how close we were to those Vietnamese, and you see it right in the pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Not a one of my men ever thanked General Dang for saving their lives, even though I gave them, as soon as I found out where he was and I got him into this country, against the best wishes of the CIA, they absolutely refused to write or call or anything to General Quang Van Dang to thank him for saving their lives, because they were told not to.
They must have been threatened pretty
yep.
good.
Yep. Well, you know, when you grow up in a military organization that trains persons within it to assassinate anybody they're asked to, it's easier to threaten somebody when you're in that kind of an organization. It'd be like, you know, the thing about the mafia that's kind of neat is they're a very close family. And nobody goes against the leader or tries to hurt anybody else within that company, more or less, within that mafia group. And that was a lot like we were like, you know, in the Green Berets. Very special training, very tough training. I tell you, it's something that we should have, but have it for good purposes only, and not ever for assassinations or terrorisms or like industrial sabotage. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yes.
Would you like an example?
Go ahead.
Let's say that we had I think we got time for it.
Oh, yeah.
We had a need at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, for a special item to be made for Green Berets only, to be used on certain missions. So I go down to this factory somewhere near Fayetteville, North Carolina, and I meet with the president of the factory, the chief executive officer, whatever you want to call him, and I have a drawing, a very good drawing of what we want, an engineered drawing, and we tell him that we'd like him to make 500 of them, and 50 of them would come to us for our use, and 450 he would give to other countries, even our enemies, just so that their actual use or where they're actually being used and by who they're being used couldn't be traced. And it all have to be done in secret with absolutely no indication to anybody that he's even making the things. And he refuses to do it. Well, you know, one of the big things we did, we were trained in how to use snakes. And we actually captured snakes. We had to buy some sometimes if we couldn't capture enough for use. But let's say that president of that company came in the next morning and he opens up his desk drawer and a rattlesnake jumps right up out at him, but it defanged. And when he picks himself up, he'll look and there'll be a note in that drawer saying the next time there'll be fangs. Then we get the contract to make those things that he wouldn't make. That's what we call industrial sabotage, or one of the terrorism, one or the other.
Wow.
But those kind of things can happen. I'm sure have happened. I've been involved in a number of different things, none of which could I ever include even in the book The Devious Elite, except for references to how they were to function, and never actually, I would never actually want anybody to admit they really did it, because there's just no safeguard to protect you.
Mm-hmm.
So, we've talked about a lot of different things today.
Yeah, and it is getting about time to wind it down for the evening and mention your book again, because again, that's one of your one of the main things is to try to get some of these copies out there. And
right.
And your website is
expendableelite.com, and the telephone number to order a book is 800-556-2012. Now, the publisher bent over backwards, by the way, to have this book, which is over 500 pages, only $20, $19.95 plus the mailing expenses. The original edition, which was 100 pages less, was $29.95. But we wanted as many people in this world to get to the truth, to read the truth, and to be able to prove to them that it's the truth by having information from the trial, and even give them information on how to get to the website and actually read the entire 7-day transcript of the trial. If they don't think that we're telling the truth, just hear it right there and have it proven to them, so to speak. But that's the telephone number, 1-800-556-2012. I can't thank you enough for having the courage to have me on your program and to be able to tell the people, your listeners, the truth about what I know about to be the truth. I really appreciate it.
And I really appreciate appreciate you coming on my program and for your bravery on writing this and getting the information out. I mean, it's important to get the truth out there.
Amen.
Right.
This, all the courage came from the Lord. I just did the mechanical part.
Well,
I hope that you can get Chris Milligan on your program.
Well, I will certainly pursue that, and I will say, good night, and thanks a lot for coming on our program.
God bless you.
Okay.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.